If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today. Kate Kritz is an acclaimed multidisciplinary artist known for her intricate, time-intensive works that tackle challenging societal issues. Her work spans various mediums, including embroideries, paintings, and sculptures, often reflecting on cultural and political themes. Kate's powerful pieces have been showcased internationally, and she continues to influence and provoke through her art and her writing. Her new book, Art From Your Core, is an inspirational call to action for people pursuing a creative path. It encourages you to find your own voice, helps you clear the obstacles that might get in your way, and how you can intensify your creative vision. This is the first part of our needle exchange, and Kate and I have a great conversation about that process, about how you can evolve your artistic flavour, how you can take those first steps, whether art needs to be big or small, how you can balance finding your artistic voice with making a living. We also talk about Kate's childhood and how she got into this kind of work. There's a mic drop moment in there that I will leave for you to find. And we also touch on the process of working with hair, something that's been a theme of Kate's work for years. I love talking with Kate. I've been a fan of hers for a very long time, and it was great to talk about all this kind of work. We'll be back next week with the second part of the interview, where we get into her more political side of things and the work that she's done to do with the Make America Great Again campaign and the influence that's had on the world. Suffice to say, Kate is not impressed. If you enjoyed the show, please leave a review on your favourite podcasting platform so that other people can feel inspired to have a listen. And I hope you'll join me next week for the second part of this conversation. Enjoy the show. I wanted to start with a quote. Is that right? Can I start with a quote?
Okay. Okay. Great. Sure.
Creativity is one of the survival mechanisms of our collective souls. I refuse to believe that our story will end with capitalism and cynicism snuffing out the magnanimous artistic impulse that has been with us since the beginning of recorded history. Never forget that we have the power to shape the art world we want. Discuss.
It's pretty thorough, isn't it? Well, you know, that comes from my book. And when I wrote that book, I was trying to essentially pass on to the next generation the idea that art has power to shape our environment. And I think that for a long time now, we've been sort of veering over to the commercial and the entrepreneurial, and I can see the benefit of that. You know, we're fighting against the starving artist trope, and I want people to make money. But the idea is that art has always been a powerful force that did help shape our history, and I don't want people to forget that. And I think it's very easy to forget that in the environment that we're surrounded with. I mean, it really, literally everywhere you look, we've got advertisements and, you know, people are paying for our attention. And so I just wanted to make a kind of last plea for art as meaning and art as sustenance. So that's basically what that's about.
Let's talk about the book. It's called Art from Your Core. I'm going to say I've dipped in and out of it because it's quite the tome. I think it's magnificent.
Yes,
if
it
I
is.
May say so. It's magnificent. It's Thank very you. Brave. It's very bold. And I like the fact that I think you said it's kind of, it's written with students in mind, but I think it's written for anybody who wants to be creative. And to me, it just feels like it's, I mean, it's partly a sort of toolkit, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
But I think it's there to sort of help people negotiate their own paths. I've had this conversation quite a lot with people about the creative path. But it seems as though, yeah, you've very much thought this through, put a kind of process in place, and then really you're just holding people's hands as they get brave with themselves.
Exactly. This class existed as a regular semester class, and it also exists as a workshop. And so I had the whole thing kind of laid out before I started writing the book. But you know, the idea is that akin to therapy, we sort of strip away all of the negative influences that might have steered you in wrong directions. And then we do some exercises to sort of help you get to know yourself and build your own core. And the idea is that we, you know, most artists that I admire anyway, they don't just get, you know, a great idea. They actually are carrying out a sustained investigation over the course of their life. And so I think that I've seen a lot of people teaching for 30 years. I've seen a lot of people who kind of go off on one path and then, you know, make a big turn and decide to change, and then another one and another one. But they're not building on anything, and they're not stopping to kind of consider who they are and what their unique point of view is. And that's something that's pretty impossible to teach in a classroom because you might have 20 or 30 students, but I found a way to individualize it. So that's what's different about it, I guess, is it's got all these exercises and each person's going to come up with very different answers. And then we kind of put them all together and people will sort of discover the art that they were born to make. And usually people come out with a couple of good ideas for what direction they might want to go in. But I also give them the tools to figure out what needs to be made next and how to determine that. And the last part of the book is strengthening. Mm. So it's intensifying your voice, distilling your voice, because, you know, what artists are doing is they make their own, you know, secret sauce, and then they make their own, you know, whatever, their own cookies, their own crackers, and they dip the meat crackers in the meat sauce, and they are distilling themselves. They are kind of getting down to what they alone have to say and what's unique to them. So, and we talk about fear a lot. Mm. That's something that I know a lot about. So, you know, I love the idea that when I start making something, I don't know if it's going to turn out or not. That's like the most exciting thing to me. So a lot of people, you know, talk to me about bravery. And so I figured that that's something that really deserved to be discussed.
Yeah, I suppose that the thrill of which you speak is also the thing that terrifies the bejesus out of someone in the first part of their journey, isn't it? It's the same feeling,
yes,
right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I often promise my students an A if they'll take the risk. I don't care how it turns out. you know, because they could dance around that for months or even years. So I'm really trying to kind of cut through all of that. And, you know, I also talk about listening to the universe, which, you know, if somebody would have said that to me 30 years ago, I would have rolled my eyes and said, you know, oh, this person's way too flaky for me. But a lot of the artists that I admire, when I read their biographies and such, they're following something that wants to come through them. And so I use Philip Guston as an example, because he had these figures that he's famous for. They were trying to fight through and come out for 10 years. And so after that, in all of his interviews, he talks about trusting the voice, or the, you know, the third hand, or, you know, he refers to it in different ways, but sort of brushing all the exterior stuff away and saying what's trying to get out.
I'm always fascinated by people, and I've interviewed a few in previous episodes of this, people who can't help but make the work, you know, people who have to, because the work is just coming through them, and it's all they can do to just get it out with a needle and thread. Like, I find that quite a fascinating thing, because there's such a purity to that. And I guess there are different degrees, aren't there? I want to, do you think everybody, well, I know you think everybody has an artistic voice, right?
I do.
And do you think that the skill is then to understand the voice and to not second guess yourself? Would that be a fair way of putting it?
That would be yes, because, you know, there's so many forces that are coming at you, trying to steer you in one direction or another, especially in school. Mm. You know, I've had students come to me and say, well, this professor said this and this professor said that, and I don't know what to do. And so I talk about what do you do with feedback? Like, how do you, and I use the metaphor of eating, you know, you take a taste of something and you spit it back out. That's not for you. Or you take a taste of something and you're like, okay, that's interesting, but I don't want any more. Or you take a taste of something and you're saying, yes, like, this is the best thing I've ever tasted. I want more. And so I think people's opinions are like that too. You have to be able to parse out when somebody has an agenda, when, you know, they themselves were taught 30 years ago that, you know, abstract work is the most spiritual, or political work is didactic, or whatever, because we've all got these voices in our head. So that's why I'm trying to strip everything away. And, you know, we do that before we start investigating what wants to come through us.
And that's like, I was going to say, it's a very modern condition, but to peel away the marketing messages, and I use that term pretty broadly, but the messages we're told by other people for agendas that serve their purposes or whatever, sometimes that feels impossible, right?
It does. It does, because they're coming at us from every direction, you know, and I mean, I think that social media has put another layer on that, because we all want likes, right? We all want people to say, oh, that's brilliant. And, you know, the fact is that when you're pushing boundaries, rarely do people say that. You know, it takes time to process what you're doing for the audience. And so, you know, I think that we're in an especially dangerous time, because there's this temptation all the time to, you know, say, well, everyone loved the red one, let me do another red one. And that's, you know, that's going to take you down a path that is their path. It's not your path, you know? And I say, you know, in the book, would you have a committee in your studio telling you what to make? And everybody says, oh, no, 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 no. And then I say, well, why is catering to likes any different? It's the same thing.
Yeah. What's the trade-off between that principle of, like, following your own artistic voice and then trying to make a living?
Well, I address that. There's a sort of elephant in the room chapter. And I think that that's another thing, and I make a lot of suggestions from all the artists that I've known. You know, people do it in different ways. I'm not trying to preach one way or another. You know, some people make smaller things that they know people will buy, and then they save their experimental stuff. Other people have something that's totally separate that they do to earn money. And then, you know, I mean, I teach and now I write. And I'm thinking about retiring from teaching, and I'm actually considering, you know, a different business that I think I would enjoy. But I think everybody's got to make that decision for themselves. And my message is just don't neglect what you feel you need to do. You know, it's, I just think it's really easy, and I've done it. I know this. It's really easy to keep putting off that thing that you want to try, you know? And so it sometimes even success gets in the way. You know, everyone wants a hair embroidery and they're all out at other shows. And so, you know, oh no, I need another hair embroidery. And before you know it, 2 years have passed and I haven't, you know, gotten to try that thing I want to try. And so, you know, that's all I'm advocating for, that you save some part for your core voice.
And do you think that one of the mistakes that people might make when pursuing their own artistic agenda is thinking that it's got to be something big, you know, and that maybe, like, I was just thinking about my next door neighbor, right? Mm-hmm. A lady called Viv. She's in her 70s and she makes Welsh cakes.
Oh, okay.
And she just gives them to people.
Right.
And in some ways, that's kind of like her art, you know, because she just does it and she's very driven to do it. And it's not like she's not looking to exhibit them in galleries. She's not looking to make 16-foot high towers out of them. It's like a quiet art. And I sometimes think that's what I mean. Sometimes I think we make a mistake because we think that it's got to be something dramatic. It's got to be something, you know, but to me, it feels like the art is just that expression of you, whether it's just you've got a really tidy lawn, you know, but that's your art, isn't it? It can be that sort of reflection.
Right. I believe that as well, you know, and my creativity manifests itself all over my house and all over my lawn. And, you know, I mean, I just think we need that as human beings. And I think we need it now more than ever because it's that tactility. You know, we need to touch things. We need to interact with things. You know, everything is a screen. It's all just sort of smooth and glossy. And we're human beings. And I feel like we're neglecting this whole other side of ourselves. I mean, you probably see that. There are so many more people, I think, doing different kinds of needlework than there were before. I mean, I just think that people need to do things with their hands. So
I think it's such a double-edged sword. Like, I look at Instagram and I think Instagram really accelerated the inspiration for people, you know, made it easier to see that, made it much more accessible. Mm-hmm. But it is such a double-edged sword, like you say, because I don't think we are designed to process the dopamine fix that you get, you know, there's all of these systems, aren't there?
Yeah.
It's the same as like ultra processed foods. Like, we're not designed to handle flavor enhancers that we've been giving ourselves for 50 years or whatever. And I just think it's trying to find that balance, isn't it? And trying to sort of explain that. Mm-hmm. I've got two young children who aren't into phones yet. And at some point they will be because they see them. And I'm sort of secretly hoping that a lot of these systems might have broken by the time that they get there, because then you've got half a chance.
Me too.
It feels really hard to sort of undo it. But I mean, in the book, there's a section I was quite drawn to where you talk about the crisis of meaning. And I think that's really important, because I think back in the day, we didn't have messages bombarded at us so we could just find ourselves for better or worse. Whereas now, there's a really great documentary called A Century of a Self, which just talks about, it's an Adam Curtis documentary, and it talks about, you know, 150 years of marketing messages that have been underpinned by psychology, and how we just don't know. We don't know that we're being marketed to half the time, but it feels like that's the crisis that you're talking about.
Absolutely. And the reason that the book is called A Holistic Guide to Visual Voice is because of that, because I think that it's our job as artists to cultivate meaningful lives, to make meaningful art, whatever that art is, you know, whether the rest of the world is appreciating it or not. But, you know, I've had students come up to me and like, show me their work. And they're like, there's something missing in this work. And I think it's hard to, know who you are and have a strong sense of that without making deliberate efforts to shut out some of the noise. And so there's a whole chapter that, you know, nobody wants to read, but is going to want to read, called The Noise. And that's the most scientific chapter. That's the one that really tells us, hey, you know, if you go away on a camping trip for 5 days, your creativity will be boosted by 50% when you get back. And, you know, I'm not a Luddite. I use the internet. I use my phone. But I set timers because I want to own my life. I want to be proactive and not reactive. And I think that the way we're being bombarded, it puts us in a position where we're reacting to that all the time. You know, when your phone buzzes, even if it's not ringing, you have a startle response, which is stress, right? And so a lot of times if you're distracted by something, it takes you up to 20 minutes to get back to what you were doing, if you ever return at all. So, you know, these are things that I'm always thinking about this. Like somebody invents some great new thing, and then who is doing the research to figure out whether this is good for us or not? And usually that comes later. The scientists catch up when we have a problem, you know, when parents talk to their kids and their kids won't answer because they're plugged in. So, you know, I advocate for trying to build a life that has meaning for yourself and, you know, to have some quiet in built into your life too, because we're all so busy, to be able to think. That's how we gestate, you know? I mean, people always joke about getting good ideas in the shower, and it's probably the only time that we're alone without something, you know, affecting us, you know?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right, isn't it? Until they create a fully waterproof phone and then we're completely screwed.
Speakers.
I think it's true. I mean, I think that in some ways that's where needlework has an advantage over some other art forms, I think, because you can't rush it. You have to take your time. And that slowness is kind of inherent in part of the process, isn't it? And that's the slowness that, for me, the meditativeness of it was the thing that got me in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose you're in agreement with that because of your personal practice anyway. I just wonder, when you're teaching students, are they across all different kinds of media and disciplines?
Yes. I've taught painting and color theory, and I teach visual voice classes and drawings, primarily what I'm teaching right now.
But I wonder whether you just notice any difference between certain applications of media and that like thoughtfulness process, whether there are some like needlework that lend themselves to a bit more philosophical reflection by the nature of the process.
I think that people are drawn to the people that are drawn to do needlework understand and appreciate that slowness, and that it's meditative, and that, you know, it's reparative in some cases. It feels that way anyway. I know I have students who would never do needlework, who, you know, because I teach it even in my drawing classes. I teach in the second or the third drawing class, I teach them needlework as mark making. And, you know, you've always got the ones who've got the knots and the, you know, like, and then you have people who just hook into it, and that's all they do, you know? Mm. So I think there's something very special about working with a needle and thread and with fabric, you know, where it's something we're all really familiar with. For me, I feel like it is a calming process in and of itself, you know, and I can take it anywhere. I can take it to the doctor's office. Like, you know, I've always got this bag with me.
Because the thing, I'm appreciating the calmness, because I think one of the things I've always felt with your work, bearing in mind that I guess I've known of you for like over a decade now, which is a bit mad, really, but it has always been a good bit of rage. I've always felt like with you, there's always some rage in Kate's work in some form or another, even before it became like overtly political, even in the early days of oubliettes and those kind of things. It was kind of, there was a darkness, there was a sort of sinisterness there. There was something that you were, whether you were trying to exercise it from your system or whether you were just looking at the world around you, I'm not sure which way it came, but there's always been this, darkness.
Mm-hmm. I think it's both. I think I'm still exercising it from my system, but I think that, you know, originally the work was probably more personal, you know, just family dysfunctionality and all that kind of stuff. And then when my daughter was born, I just started looking at the world around me in a completely different way. And, you know, I feel this sounds like a very naive thing to say, but I feel like I'm trying to fix the world for my daughter. And I'm not arrogant enough to think that I can, but I do think that sometimes you can budge the needle just a little bit in the right direction. I'm pretty good at getting my work out in front of people. So, I think that now I'm responding to the outside world, whereas kind of in the first half of my career, I was responding to the inside.
As an aside, I never really understand why, as a parent, like, you do things yourself that you don't want your children to do because you know that they're bad for them. Why do we do that all the time? Don't eat this thing.
Well, I'm the oldest sibling, and so I even did that with my brothers and sisters. You know, there's this whole thing inside where you're like, I survived, but I was just lucky, you know? Yeah. And... But, you know, you the world changes and there are threats that didn't exist. I mean, what did we do? We were running around playing all day long and came in when we were called for supper and no one knew where we were, or what we were doing. And my daughter's fascinated by all this. And I, you know, she asked me the other day about my childhood, and I said, I remember my mom giving me money and sending me to the store for a carton of milk when I was 4 years old. It was right down the street, you know, and it's not like bad things didn't exist back then, but we read about them now a lot more, and the internet's an additional danger, you know, especially when you have girls, it seems.
I wonder whether that's a thing, like you say, it's like our parents, I don't know if it was naive or maybe the world sort of isn't that bad. If we turn down the volume and all the things telling us the world that's bad, then maybe we'd all feel the same way about that. But it's always a funny duality. Let's talk about childhood. Let's not just as a broad concept. Let's talk about your childhood, because I know that you've been stitching and making art for a long time. Have you been sort of making art from a small child onwards?
Yes. I think I started seriously drawing in fourth or fifth grade, but I was always doing crafts. You know, I had embroider on your jeans crafts and things like that. Sometimes I didn't finish them. I remember that if I wasn't really interested in them, they didn't get finished. But I've always liked to make things with my hands, and I've always been somewhat introverted too. I need time for myself that's quiet. And that was hard in a house, you know, of seven people. So,
yeah. How many siblings have you got?
I've got two brothers and two sisters. They're all younger than
me. Right. Right.
So was there a period where you had time for yourself and then they came along and you just went, oh, that's the end of that then?
I don't really remember back that far, but we're like the first three of us are super close in age. Like we're all a year and a half away from each other. So we were sort of one pack. And then there was a period of time for two younger. So that, you know, we all did plays together, the three of us. And, you know, my mother taught us before we went to kindergarten. My dad was a high school teacher, so he got some old desks that were being thrown away, and, you know, she would actually hold classes for us. I suppose it's an easy way to get all three of us in one place paying attention.
Yeah. And so are you all quite creative? Was there a lot of that happening?
I think so. I mean, in different areas. We, you know, my youngest brother is a DJ, and my brother, you know, does shows for people like Armani and stuff like that. I mean, he makes all the visuals and on the screen behind them. So, and then we've got a scientist. We don't know where she came from, but she's brilliant too.
Just to balance things out in a sort of karmic scale or something.
It's a biology thing. Someone told me that, you know, in order for us to survive, your kids have to be different from one another so that one of them will be likely to succeed where the other one might not, or be, you know, be more adaptable to conditions. So that's, you
know. Not sure I want to know that fact, because then you spend the rest of your time just wondering if you're the one.
It's not. I know I'm the one.
Yeah, there you go. Did you do a lot of needlework type stuff at school?
Not at all. I'm about to make a confession on this particular podcast. I think there was a period of time when I was an undergraduate where I was a voracious reader, and I had read about the hierarchy of art. And I had a little button that said, I don't do crafts.
Mic drop.
Right? I know. But, and I went to a graduate school that was really well known for fiber art, and I never took a class, and I could beat myself now for not doing that. It was really, you know, several years into my professional career when I was painting. But I've always liked to make things for my house. So I started to make these things, and then curators would come over and they'd be picking paintings for a show. And then they'd wander over to some little thing that I'd sewn, you know, and they'd say, I want to put this in the show. And I'd be like, really? You know, so you know, and I think that time coincided with when I got tenure at my university. And so that is a very freeing thing, you know. There are people who could argue when I came up for tenure, oh, she's all over the place, which is where I am right now. But, you know, I really wanted tenure. I really wanted to be in the lifeboat. So I was kind of doing my thing, you know, and I was getting shows, and I was, you know, I've always been sort of DIY in my art career. So you know, when I had a chance to show with a gallery, I was like, no, I need to get tenure, and my work needs to be circulating at all times. And so I didn't go the gallery route because of that. I may have, you know, cut off my nose to spite my face, but I literally was driving my work all over the country in a rental truck at that
point. But at that point, it was mostly like painting, that kind of territory.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then tenure, and then boom, fiber got started, more momentum. And I think now the last painting that I did, I finished maybe, I don't know, three, 4 years ago. So.
And then when Like, for instance, with your use of hair, when did those kind of ideas start to creep in?
Well, I was thinking about what is the most potent material that you could use in terms of meaning, right? And hair can be red, like the rings of a tree. So you look at it, you chop a tree down, you can see drought, you can see, you know, any disease years where they then survived afterwards or whatever. And the same thing happens with your hair. So if you're pregnant, you know, if you go through a time of extreme stress, that's visible in your hair. And so, to my mind, that got me started on this idea that, wow, you know, if I make art and I sew with hair, it already has this inherent meaning in it. And like, I just thought that's really the most potent art material I can think of. Our experiences are like in there. So that developed even more, because in the beginning I was using my own hair, and then I was thinking about, you know, formal aspects like value. And so then I bought some hair for a while, but then I decided it's really all about where this hair comes from. And so I made the nest, which is made from the hair that was on my head when I was carrying my daughter. And I made, you know, my silver dagger, which I crowdsourced the gray hair of all these women. And I just think about it as all of us sitting in a room and telling our stories, you know, it's all in there. So, you know, I really like feel that, but I don't know how many I have in me, if any at all, because it's an excruciating process the way I do it. Some people do it in a more loosey-goosey way, but I, you know, the way that I do it, tying a knot in the beginning, sewing, tying a knot in the end, it's taken, you know, a couple of years off the use of my hand. So it would have to be a pretty important piece for me to do another one.
Is it like fragile or not fragile, or does it depend and you only find out that it's fragile when it breaks on you?
You find out when it breaks on you, but I can tell you right now that the blonde hair that I've used breaks easier. And I don't know if that's because it wasn't really blonde hair, it was processed, or it inherently breaks. And one of the things that's really interesting, if you're kind of getting into it, is that the hair that's close to your head is much thicker than the hair at the very end. So I can start stitching an area with hair, and I'm trying to maintain a certain value across the area, and then it will either suddenly get lighter or darker depending upon which end of the hair I finish with. And so I've had to rip out those stitches and then, you know, test and find another hair that's of similar thickness that I can use to finish up the area of stitching. So it's pretty obsessive.
It sounds like there are other media that might be simpler to use as a whole or something.
Yes. Although I find gold thread harder to use than hair.
Interesting.
I think that's really a challenge.
I think that the other thing that strikes me is, as you said, you know, you start using it because it's an interesting material, but you can't help but then have it as like a narrative device. You can't disconnect like the way it's come. And it's just not the same, is it, with cotton or some of these abstract things or polyester? You never it's funny how those voices of those people kind of spoke to you or made you pay attention to it. I was particularly taken, I think it's rupture as well, isn't it? The one that's like a broken piece of glass or whatever, like a bullet hole.
Yeah,
right?
It's a, a bullet hole in glass. And there, luckily I have lots of Facebook friends, there I crowdsourced from people who had experienced extreme loss that either was recent and they had shorter hair, or it might have, you know, happened a few years ago, but they have longer hair. And so I wanted, so the rupture is not just the rupture in the glass, you know, referring to gun violence, but it's a rupture in the time before and after the incident, which, you know, gives me chills even when I'm talking about it, this whole, like, how your life gets transformed by loss. And so that's, you know, that's where that came from. And it's a strange piece. It's really hard to see from a distance, you know. Mm. It's something that you've really got to get up on top of. But one of the great things about hair, especially gray hair, is that it's not white. It's translucent or almost transparent. And okay. So when you shine a light on it in a gallery, it glistens like metal. And right. So that, or like glass, you know. Mm. So that was the glass and the metal that I was, and I didn't know that when I started. That was just a happy accident that I, you know, figured this out somewhere down the road, that, and it's pretty amazing, actually. It's kind of like those, you know, those funky lights that have the, you know, the sort of LED at the very tip, That's what it's like, you know, it sort of carries light. So it's really interesting.
I think, isn't polar bear hair supposed to be the same? Like,
I don't know.
I think polar bears, like, their hair's transparent, but there's so much of it, and I think their skin's quite dark, but it comes off as white because it's reflecting the light around it and stuff.
I've never used polar bear hair. I think that would be maddening.
That would be.
I'm not going to try it.
I'm not going to try and get that from the source at all. When you did the rupture piece, people sent you hair in. Like, I've done a few crowdsource projects and people always want to tell you the tales of them. My thought is that with a project like that, you could personally get a bit overwhelmed by all those tales. Did you say, I just want the hair? Or did you leave it open for people to share what they wanted to?
I left it open, and a couple of people shared their stories, but most of them did not, and that's fine with me. I sort of trust them, and I take them at their word, and I knew there were stories. That's all I needed to know. You know, that they experience the emotion and they experience the disruption.
I guess there's a gamble, isn't there, with something like that, that actually the stories change the path that you'd sort of started out on or something, and it might change the conversation you're having as part of that work or something.
To a certain extent, you know, I just think it was sort of, you know, broad enough. My crowdsourcing definition was sort of broad enough because, you know, I had people who'd lost lovers and people who'd lost children and, you know, just lots of different stories. But to me, it was about the transformation part, the transformation in the hair, the transformation in the life.
Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange, that's NWDL.exchange, with any thoughts, comments or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needleexchange. See you next time.